In this week's programme, the topic is silence. Colm Kenny's book is called The Power of Silence, Silent Communication in Daily Life. Professor Kenny has gathered under one set of covers everything you've ever wanted to know about silence. A communications expert at DCU, he's acutely alert to the paradox that only by breaking our silence can we address the nature of silence. He examines the phenomenon under three main headings: the arts, therapy, and religion. Our three reviewers this evening are representative of those three crucial domains. Anne Fogarty is Professor of James Joyce Studies at UCD. Rob Wetherill is a professional therapist. His most recent book, Forgetting Freud, is Psychoanalysis in Retreat, has just been published. Paddy Quinn is Professor of Philosophy at All Hallows College in Dublin. He's author of Philosophy of Religion A to Z. Anne Fogarty, what did you make of this book?
It's fascinating and a timely subject and one in which people are continuously interested, as Colm Kenny shows. But of course, silence is unfashionable nowadays. Mm. It's hard to define. One can come up with many different categories and definitions of silence, as Colm Kenny does here. But silence always remains paradoxical because you have to link it to whatever might be its opposite: noise or language or speech or meaning, signification or something like that. And so one has to tread a very complicated ground in order to work out really what silence is. Can we know it? Can we really hear it at all? He quotes Thoreau, who's moved on one occasion when he talks about silence in nature and talks about silence being audible. And that is the big question. Is silence audible now, particularly in 21st century culture? And can we be silent anymore? And there seem to be no injunctions anymore to be silent. You have all these maxims and proverbs from earlier other cultures and earlier phases of our own culture, where it was a maxim, a wise saying to remain silent and to keep mum or shtum or something like that. Whereas you can't imagine that anymore as a piece of advice being given to a politician or anyone. We seem to be forced to speak and communicate and be noisy.
Do you go along with that, Rob?
Very much, yes. This is a strange book in a way. I mean, it's impressive in its range. But silence, as Anne is saying, really is something that, you know, is precisely what you can't pin down. It's like trying to catch water. Silence is paradoxical. And we talk about the power of silence. Silence, like suicide, is complete in itself. You know, it doesn't lack anything. It's total. And the opposite, I suppose, is speech. And
Just let me think on that. Silence doesn't lack anything. Paddy Quinn.
I think it's, I mean, difficult to define silence. Obviously, it's the absence of sound, but it's more an experience, I think, that's being discussed throughout this, what I think is a very impressive book. And one of the things that strikes me, really struck me during the week, is that children, small children, can be silent. And the reason I'm saying this is that we've recently had a grandson. And one of the fascinating things about him is that he will look around, you know, where he is in fascination. He won't say anything. He'll just keep looking. And, like, I think silence has to do with, obviously, experiences like awe, wonder. And, of course, there are philosophical points of departure. And Aristotle is somebody who mentioned those. There are also religious points of departure. So it's an experience which I think is difficult to define. It's not merely the absence of sound. It's basically being able to just experience what there is, almost in a way where the person isn't somehow part of it themselves.
Rob, I just wonder how you develop that point that silence is, which sounds very interesting to me, that silence is complete in itself.
Well, if you think of speech, which is not quite the opposite of silence, but speech, I think this book is about silence in relation to speech. And that's the way I've taken it anyway. And if you think about speech, it's incomplete. That we can never say really what we want to say. And this is, I suppose, the whole basis for analysis. We can never say the complete thing. We can say partially. We can, if we're religious or if we're a poet, we can get pretty close to the real thing, but we never can say the real thing. Silence is the opposite of that. It's power in itself, a hidden power. It's not the sort of phallic power that we talk about in the ordinary world. It's not that phallic power of visibility. It's a hidden power. And linked, in a certain sense, to the feminine. Not to women, I hasten to add, but to the feminine. I think he misses an opportunity here to say much, much more, if you like, I suppose, almost in a political sense, about the operational or instrumental use of language, what we have now, computer languages, Twitter, Facebook, and so on, where there must be no silence.
What do you
know, it eliminates silence.
What do you think was the author's point of departure? I mean, was this animated by a question, by a set of questions? What do you think got him going, Anne?
I think in part it does seem to be a personal quest. He ends the book with an epilogue where he talks about being out in the Irish landscape and experiencing silence. And the core of the book is silence and religion. He's very influenced by Max Picard's book, The World of Silence, where Picard defines silence as wholly uselessness. And I think that's the journey that the book wants to take.
I just want to stay on that point, Patty. The question of... key question that animated him.
I think he's into communications. That's his business.
Sure.
And, you know, communication tends to mean something kind of active. It means discourse. It means, you know, exchanged sound and so on. So I think it just probably occurred to him, you know, well, where does silence fit into all that? Because silence is a form of communication and it can be used as a weapon, for instance. It can express. One of the things actually I noticed in I've already said is a very good book is he doesn't mention the culture of silence. And that's a phrase that's used by Paulo Freire in The Pedagogy of the Oppressed.
Meaning
there are people in society, the poor, the marginalised, who don't have a voice, who don't feel that they can express themselves, and who really are signifying their powerlessness.
So in other words,
it's a political
understanding
dimension.
Of it.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I would have liked to have seen something about that, but
This idea that it's part of communication, I was struck, I think, by, I mean, probably the sexiest part of the book is where he's looking at cross-cultural understandings of silence, you know, that even within Asia, Japanese silence is noticeable. And in that context, he says, and this intrigued me, just as words may be used honestly or dishonestly, so too would silences, Rob.
Yes, and I suppose that's where the power of silence comes in, because we don't know if somebody's silent. We don't know what they're thinking. There's an interesting case which I would have liked him to have developed in the therapy chapter, I think, in the book, where a young psychiatrist sees a young girl for, I think, 6 sessions, and she stays silent, the patient stays silent in 5, and the psychiatrist quite, you know, understandably says, well, listen, I don't think we're going to get anywhere unless you're going to speak. And then the young woman goes off and commits suicide.
He does mention that point that just as in media, so in therapy, people feel that they're not really doing their job unless they're talking. So how do you deal when you encounter silence in your sessions? How do you decode?
Well, it is difficult, and it's probably one of the hardest things to sit with a silent person who's clearly suffering but not willing to speak. It is extremely hard. That's why I thought that story of the psychiatrist was I would have liked to have heard more, but that would have been a different book.
But it's a weapon.
And how do you deal with it? Well, you just wait. Now often there are different sounds within the silence and different sighs and different atmospheres.
It's a classic way, isn't it, in ordinary interpersonal relations.
Psychoanalysis tries to actually create a space of silence.
Sure, but I'm saying it's a way of decoding. Yes. Forget the therapeutic setting. In ordinary relations, a way of decoding whether or not there's something wrong, Paddy.
Yes. I just to follow on a little bit from what Rob was saying there, I mean, R.D. Lang, again, I don't think he's mentioned here in the book, but he gave, there are some very interesting examples of him as a therapist where he simply sat down with this girl who was saying nothing, and that was the communication that they had. So silence there really meant establishing an area of comfort for and ease for both of the people. Obviously, if you're listening to people, whether it's in a therapeutic situation or, say, in a in an academic situation where you're advising, you do have to listen and you have to learn to stop
but
talking.
But I was thinking of things, Anne, like, you know, the she gave him the silent treatment, or he gave her the silent treatment.
He talks about those forms of silence as well.
As weapons,
they're uncomfortable silence. Yeah. He talks about self-silencing, self-censorship, and silence being used as a weapon, a technique of refusal, or some mode of retaliation. And particularly in very close, intimate relationships, silences fulfill all kinds of functions there, and we need to be adept at reading those silences. But I think he's also stressing that our culture actually doesn't really train us to listen to silence all that much anymore, so that we're not as adept at interpreting silence as we should be.
Or tolerating it, even. I mean, there was a thing on, I think it was on Pat Kenny's Frontline, where somebody said, can we not do away with the Angelus now that we're, a multicultural country? Mm. And Pat Kenny said, what would we do with the silence, that people turn off? And this is hugely political, and I think he misses an opportunity. You ask Andy where he's coming from with this book, and I don't know that he's really coming from anywhere apart from the fact that it's, this is a potentially interesting topic.
That is it.
That might be being unkind.
That he's collected the data.
Yes, over the years, perhaps.
And then out of that, questions may come.
Because the only reason he gives is at the beginning, where his mother tells him, you're asking too many questions, just be quiet, we're on the bus.
And yet I wonder, is that totally fair to him? I mean, Paddy,
he may well
have started with
yes,
the
but
question,
I think in communication, we're always hurrying other people on. It happens all the time in ordinary conversation. It happens in broadcasting. It happens all the time that people are jumping in, trying to hurry the person along. Now, in other cultures, that he mentions here, that doesn't seem to happen. People are more at ease with silence. But here, for example, people seem to want sound all the time. They have radio, radios going off in their ears. They're listening to, they're on the iPhone. It's a kind of a jumble of noise all the time that people seem to be addicted to. I think that really one of the messages of the book is basically just stop, just listen. And I think that's a very important contemporary message in terms of
communication. There was a point in the old-fashioned retreats where people for 3 days had total silence. In religious houses they have, and this is touched on here, in monasteries and so on, where they eat in silence and that kind of thing. Yeah. You think that's a value, Rob?
Oh, absolutely. And I think the saddest part of the book is the story of the silent disco, and again, he doesn't take this up as something that we seem to be doing, as something that's pretty sad about modern culture, in the sense that we can all go, we walk down the East Pier, as I do every day, and there's people with their headphones on, and they're not listening to the sounds of the sea. Even.
In the matter of literature, and as I say, the three contexts he's looking at here, at the arts, therapy and religion, he quotes someone by the name of Lawrence, a critic, saying that Virginia Woolf was the first modern woman writer to practice silence in her writing. Does that strike you as accurate, Anne?
Probably not. I think one can go much further back. I mean, one can find silence as a theme. I mean, going way back to Anglo-Saxon poetry.
No, I think
so
the first modern woman writer, probably. Yes.
And it's certainly true that Woolf, in her writing, changes language and is trying to produce a language that's closer to music, to the visual and the oral, to get away from the noisiness of language in some ways and to reach for something different, for instance, in the waves.
Isn't it interesting to read that the Greeks, for the Greeks, voice celebrated creation was silence, represented annihilation.
Yes,
that was
a wonderful point. I think it may explain why speech is so quintessential in Western culture.
And we're at the birth of democracy, of course, silence wouldn't have been very, very, very useful.
Yes, I mean, philosophy is full of discourse, as I was saying earlier. And in a sense, there are very few philosophers that I can think of in the tradition who, advocate silence. I mean, Aquinas is obviously one of them. I mean, he has this phrase in one of his books or a sentence. He says, God is honoured by silence, but not in such a way that we may say nothing of him or make no inquiries about him, but in as much as we understand that we lack the ability to comprehend him. And that's tied in, certainly, not just with philosophy, but also with the negative way, you know, where really one knows God by acknowledging the fact that one doesn't know God. So yeah. In a sense, one has to be receptive to ignorance at a profound level, rather than trying to make something of God from a human point of view. So Aquinas is one of those figures in philosophy. And Wittgenstein, of course, is the other, and he deals with Wittgenstein and Aquinas, actually, in the book here. But Wittgenstein's very interesting, because one of the ways in which he's often taken up is in terms of analysing language as a means of trying to show that language can distort our thinking. Communication can actually distort the way we think about things. And so his whole programme seems to be about pointing out that, you know, as he says, that philosophy is a battle against the bewitchment of our intelligence by means of language.
What do you think he meant when he said, you know, whereof we cannot speak, thereof one must be silent?
Yes, that's a very interesting one, because he keeps tying that in with the mystical, and it comes in into the Tractatus, the first and only book, indeed, that was published in his lifetime. And he's trying to emphasise, he says the same thing, he's talked about that book as a book on ethics. Now, in 1929, he gave a talk to the Heretic Society in Trinity College in Cambridge about ethics. And again, you see him in the lecture as kind of stumbling, trying to explain what ethics is about. And what he uses are two different examples. He says, one of the things that I can compare ethics to is it's something supernatural, he says. And not only that, but it's also it's something akin to the experience of wondering at the world, wondering at it.
But when you say, or when he said, you know, whereof you cannot speak, you must be silent. I mean, after all, within the Christian tradition, mystery is at the heart of it. And you have a tradition that's attempting to articulate it. So in a way, you could, that people could say to them, look, don't say anything.
Yes, well,
I mean, in the light of what Wittgenstein is saying.
Yes,
I mean,
but people are also caught in the trap that they have to say something. I mean, it's not possible not to communicate at some level at all. I mean, we express ourselves somehow. So, but I think what Wittgenstein is trying to emphasise is that, you know, and in the Tractatus it seems to come out, is that we can speak about what we can think about, but there are things we cannot think about.
Ah, and so in other words, where there are conceptual limits.
Where there are conceptual limits, there are linguistic limits. But actually, that's not totally true either, because the conceptual limits can be extended through metaphorical kind of speech, through mythology, through analogy, etc.
To return to the therapeutic context, Rob, when he says here that falling silent in therapy to defend ourselves against instinctual urges that threaten us is something that may happen. Falling silent for that reason, that we feel overwhelmed in some way by the dark possibilities of our instincts.
Yes, I was a bit puzzled by that, because that's probably a rather old-fashioned view in a sense of silence in therapy now. That doesn't mean it's wrong, of course, but it's trying to chase after the silence. What is the silence?
Yeah.
Come on, instead of tolerating the silence. I mean, I rather like the quote from Žižek, the Slovenian analyst, philosopher.
Yes.
He talks about, he reverses all of that. Yes. This always there is this confused murmur of the real, which is what we're talking about.
I mean, what Žižek is saying is that noise came first.
Yes,
and then silence came as the great creative act.
Yeah, exactly. The first great creative act is therefore to create silence.
Yes.
And that is precisely what one tries to do in the analytic session. The person comes in, they sit down or they lie down, and nobody says anything. Now, how unusual, that's very, very subversive now in today's world, as we've been saying, where there's just noise continuously, and we cannot tolerate any silence anywhere. And so this is so silence then is very subversive, and therefore rather than trying to chase after it and say now is it anal silence, is it retentive, is it phallic, is it aggressive, is it seductive or whatever it might be, to stay with it.
How does that strike you, Anne, in from looking at the therapeutic context in that way?
It makes absolute sense, I think, because I think silence then is fundamental. It's actually a part of being. It's certainly part of woundedness or any kind of oppressed areas within the self and a darkness within the self, but not just darkness. It's not that Greek darkness. I mean, the unvoiced is fundamental, as Zizek. He also quotes Blanchot, who sees the act of creation as linked with expression, but also with unleashing silence in some form, that's what works of art do. That's part of the power, that the artist has to go quiet first and before she or he can create something. And so that silence is part of the ineffable of paying attention to the world and paying attention to ourselves. And that I think therapy and all of contemporary trauma theory certainly recognises that there is something, the unspeakable at the heart of being, and that we have to pay attention to this unspeakable and sometimes try and voice it.
And yet try and voice it. I mean, that's the thing. Not to be, Patty, the notion of God as silence.
Yes, well, I think that has to do with awe, for example, and wonder, but not in the sense of wondering, you know, what God is or that sort of thing, but just wonder at. So silence from that point of view, and obviously within, say, the mystical tradition, and I think he deals very well with mystics like St. John of the Cross, for instance, there, you know, who wrote extensively about the silence from God in The Dark Night of the Soul, where there's no kind of experience of any kind. If there's anything, there's an experience of the absence of God that St. John of the Cross is writing about. But I don't think it's primarily a religious phenomenon or a religious response. It can be used in different ways, but silence in the face of God, I think, is a deeply religious attitude, regardless of what culture or what tradition or what form of religious belief or even none at all.
I wonder why the Quakers latched on to it more than other traditions they seem to have.
Perhaps because the other traditions are very wordy traditions, I think, you know. They like a lot of talk and silence comes in kind of, you know, as an accidental, you know, tangential episode in all of that, I think.
Yeah. I think there's another thing that's missing in my reading of the book, which I may not be complete, is that of silence and associated with radical evil. This is one of the points that Steiner makes, that, you know, holocaustal silence, he refers to it as, that no poetry after Auschwitz, you know, that Adorno phrase, that how can we say anything really after this horror?
Yeah.
And there's no mention, that, as far as I could see, of Dostoevsky, for instance, or Kafka. And this leads me then to wonder what the motive for writing this book is, because if you don't go down that road of the radical evil and silence, then it seems that there's a huge sort of area, which I suppose we're saying in a way, that of political analysis that's missing here, which leads me to think then that he doesn't really have any convictions about silence. It's an interesting topic. He lets all the other people do the work that he quotes, and there are some amazing quotes there to be mined. But his position on it seems to be rather tepid, rather postmodern, in the sense that it's more or less he's happy enough to talk about silence in movies, but he doesn't go for the deep things.
And does that strike you as reasonable?
Yes, I think it's fair. I mean, as a book, it's a treasure trove, and he's unearthed all kinds of nuggets from a huge range of writers across every kind of discipline on silence. But I think maybe he is a trained journalist as well. He's putting this stuff out there. He's not actually putting an argument together. He's suggesting certain ideas to us.
That's why he's letting us
make up our own mind.
That's why I was wondering what the original question was that really animated him, Paddy.
Well, I think, I again think that it's because by his nature he's a communicator, he's interested in communication. So, I mean, what he's giving certainly is a panoramic view which everybody can read. Now, there are certain aspects that he has left out, and certainly he doesn't probe perhaps too deeply into some that he should. And I was a bit unhappy about the end of the book, because the epilogue, because it's like he's kind of experimenting, so to speak, with silence. And he ends up by saying the very silence is an invitation to thought, to speech. I think which kind of defeats, it's too glib or something. It defeats the purpose.
Where might he have gone, Rob?
No, I mean, let me just quote this little bit here. He says that this is in relation to the camps. He says that they, the victims, took comfort from their scriptures is evident in the fact that even as they were being gassed, some sang psalms. Now, of course, it's true that they did, but the way it's put there seems to me to be completely banal. And I would say, you know, glib, to put it mildly. And that's what slightly irritates me
about
the book.
You have the sense that he's not sufficiently attentive, alert to the reality.
That he's talking
evil,
about something that is the most powerful thing, which is silence. And yet he's doing it in a very uncommitted way. I don't feel he's committed to any of the things that he's saying. That, as Anne said, they're put out there for us to consume. It's rather like having opera, you know, behind the Heineken ads on the rugby. You know, people say, oh, it's great. People are exposed to opera. You know, now that's the lads are being exposed to opera when they're drinking the Heineken. But somehow or other, that's not the sort of exposure you want of people, in relation to something serious.
He also talks about the danger that we commodify everything now in 21st century culture, instrumentalise everything. And maybe that's partly what's happening to silence, even though he recognises that danger himself in the book.
Yes, I mean, he's alert to the paradoxes involved.
But that he can't go the route of George Steiner and look at these kind of dark silences at the core of the 20th century. And all of late 20th century art is an attempt somehow to overcome that darkness within silence and make it speak in some fashion for us, but leave it silent too.
Mind you, he does poke fun at Steiner, who, you know, talks about the primacy of silence and then goes on and on. We've been discussing The Power of Silence, Silent Communication in Daily Life by Colm Kenny, published by Carnac. My thanks to Paddy Quinn, Anne Fogarty and Rob Weatherham. Till next week, bye-bye.